Well, welcome to this interview with me, Tim Blackmore, and a special welcome to my guest, a man who I first came across as an outstanding radio broadcaster, but who's now best known to the British public as the frontman for TV coverage of all kinds of sport, but especially rugby and tennis. He is, of course, John Inverdell. John, I first became aware of you, I think it was in Studio B9 in the bowels of Broadcasting House. It was a Saturday afternoon on Radio 2, and you were handling multiple audio sports feeds as well as instructions from your director, who I think was the brilliant Pat Thornton. How did you come to be sitting in that chair doing that job?
I thought you were going to say, Tim, that you first came across me when I was doing the 5:45 sports desk on Radio Lincolnshire on a Tuesday evening in the early 80s. But I loved radio from a very early age. I was brought up overseas, and my dad was in the forces, and we didn't have a telly. Not because we couldn't afford it, but we just didn't have a telly. And so the radio was very important to me. BBC World Service I used to listen to a lot because that was kind of the main thing that you had access to. Although on Sunday mornings, the chart show used to be played between 10 and 12. And all of us, you know, aged 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, used to gather around the radio and listen to it. And I had a chart, I had a book where I marked, you know, whether the Kinks had gone up to or down to that week and all that sort of stuff. So I just loved radio, you know, forever. And when I left university and I worked on the local paper, which was in Lincolnshire, the local radio station had a vacancy. I applied for it. Didn't think I was going to get it, but got it.
A vacancy as what?
As a reporter, news reporter. I mean, one of the very first things I ever had to do, and I think it is one of those experiences I've never forgotten, actually, that also from a production point of view, something that I've never forgotten, is I got sent out with a radio car in May 82 to interview a couple of guys who were coming back from the Falklands. But I hadn't been briefed as to why they were coming back. And I went to this village and there were marching bands and, you know, scout band and all that sort of stuff. And then these kids, because they were kids, I mean, they were, you know, way younger than me, got out of this military vehicle, minus various limbs, and I had to talk to them. And I wasn't aware, no one had told me that they were going to be like that. And it was one of the first sort of live interviews I ever had to do into the Drive Time show. And I remember thinking, first of all, you know, you blank to the producer who hadn't told me. Maybe I should have asked, but, you know, and secondly, thinking, oh my God, you know, what do you say to people in this, in a live radio situation, in a situation like this? And I suspect it was probably pretty hideous radio, but moments like that, you know, you learn from and you have to learn pretty quickly. So I stayed at Radio Lincolnshire for a few years, doing the breakfast show and things like that. And then there was an attachment available at BBC Sport. I applied for it, lucky enough to get it, and it kind of went from there.
So when you say there was an attachment, was that an attachment just as a journalist or as a presenter?
It was as a journalist in the sports room, but I didn't do any sport really at Radio Lincolnshire because I wanted to play at weekends. You know, I didn't want to have to, you know, sit in the studio, or I wanted to still run around. So I was doing mostly news stuff. And when I came down to London, I mean, I genuinely wonder how on earth I did it, but for 18 months, I double shifted most days, 4 or 5 days a week. I did Radio 2 from 5 till 1 in morning to lunchtime. And then I did Radio 4 working as a news reporter on the Today programme from 3 till 11 in the evening. And then I went home, had 5 hours sleep, turned around and went back again on the basis that at some point somebody would say, if only I might get a medal for sort of honourable service to the BBC canteen because I was in there. I had breakfast there, supper there and dinner there every single day. And somebody might say, let's give this bloke a proper job, and which they did in the end.
And what was that proper job?
The big chance I had was to present Sport on 2 as it was then, which coincided with the Seoul Olympics in 88, which was the first kind of big gig that I got offered. I did Sport on 2 for 7 years on Saturday afternoons, you know, with that famous piece of music at 5 o'clock. And in those days, 90%, 99% actually, of all big sporting events happened on a Saturday. You know, we hadn't really got into the Sunday thing by then. So I was very conscious that people were listening, all the cliches about people leaving grounds and immediately putting the radio on and hearing the scores and all that sort of stuff, which I'd done with my dad for years and years and years and years and years. So every time when you used to go, it's 5 o'clock and time for Sports Report, I used to go, whoa, isn't this great? I loved it. I mean, I really did love it.
I remember I came a couple of times and stood in the background and just watched that programme going on. And it was a phenomenal achievement with all the different feeds coming in, outside broadcast locations. Were you working with split headphone feeds? Were you able to hear two things at once? How did that work?
No, I think the thing always to do was actually just to ignore what the producer said and just go plough your own furrow. I always think that's probably the best course of action. I mean, you had information in one ear and you out the other. And I mean, one thing I would say actually about that time is, you know, you think of it in terms of sport, but I mean, I was at the helm when the Hillsborough disaster happened. That's a huge test of your ability to get a tone of an occasion right, when you know you're normally going, oh, what a goal, or whatever you're going. But, you know, that was we had a feed in the studio of the match at Hillsborough, and we could see what was happening there. And I do remember a little vignette moment I always remember about a monumental row going on that I could see through the glass, because we didn't know quite what the extent of the disaster was at that point. We knew it was bad. We'd seen bodies being removed from the ground and all that sort of stuff, and obviously the game had been called off, but all our reporters there were going, you know, it's serious, but we don't know quite how serious. And while all this was happening, I could see through the glass the producer and the editor, you know, this is radio, so it doesn't kind of work like that, but, you know, arms and flailing and all this sort of stuff, and there was clearly a very, very heated debate taking place, because that's 89, so, you know, a sports report had been going for 40 odd years by then. And they'd never, ever, ever not had the theme tune at 5 o'clock. So the row was going on with one person saying, we've got to have the theme tune. And then, you know, John's got to say, the Hillsborough disaster, blah, blah, blah. And the other person saying, on a day like today, you cannot possibly have a theme tune because the enormity of what's happening is just so terrible. So at about 1 minute to five, someone said in my ears, we may have the SIG, we may not. And I just went on the talkback when I said, no bloody SIG. And we didn't have it. But I think it probably still is the only time that it's never not been played, because it would have just been wholly inappropriate. But that was a, you know, another one of those days that you remember. And well, and actually, I do think about it quite often, actually, in terms of broadcasting, whenever you're doing anything. I mean, I think about, you know, the people who are out in Sochi at the moment. Please God, may nothing terrible happen. But you've got to have people there who are presenting, who also have the ability to react to whatever might happen. If something awful were to happen there over the next 10 days or so, in the middle of the ultimate frippery of a sporting contest, really, you've got to have the ability to just switch from being all hail fellow well met as a sports presenter and to understand the gravity of the situation that we're having to deal with in a live situation.
Well, we'll come back to the challenges of live broadcasting a little bit later on. But as well as your sports broadcasting, we've heard you fronting mainstream music and talk shows, especially on Radio 2, and you always seem to me to be able to talk about music as if that is another John Inverdale specialism. Where does music fit in your life?
It's my other great passion. It really is. I mean, my mum couldn't read music, but she could play music. And, you know, again, little things that you always remember from childhood. I'll never forget. I was ill off from school one day, and whoever was doing the lunchtime show on Radio 1 and said that they were going to have a world exclusive, the new Rolling Stones single. And Mum and I gathered around the radio, and it was Jumping Jack Flash, which she just caught immediately. And then we went to the piano that was in the front room, and she just played it from having heard it once on, you know. And it was fantastic to have somebody who was so musical in the house, who could just convey her love of it, you know, all the time, really. And I mean, the first record I was ever given was What Do You Want If You Don't Want Money by Adam Faith for my second birthday, you know. I also, the other great thing for me was that my sister was 10 years older than me, is 10 years older than me. So when I was 5 and 6, and, you know, she'd bought She Loves You, you know, you had to embrace it. How could you not?
So you were aware well before the kind of age that one would have expected a young man to become aware of.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, genuinely, when we were out in the Far East, little things. I actually met Alan Clark once, lead singer of the Hollies, because they were. I mean, I was a huge Beatles fan and Stones fan, but something about the Hollies I just thought was fantastic. Just, you know, one after the other of perfect 3-minute pop songs. I used to have this chart where I remember when I listened to the chart, and the Hollies had, you know, whatever it had been, you know, stop, had gone down 3 that week. I was livid. I wanted to sort of just say, no, this is not possible. You know, obviously something clinically insane within me. But so I've always loved music, and, you know, my record collection, I still buy CDs, last of the Neanderthals. But I just like owning music, and I love being able to put music on. And, you know, I've got the train. I mean, we're chatting now. I've just come back from Paris where I was doing a Six Nations rugby game. And I've got my iPad, which has got loads and loads of music on it and all that sort of stuff. So I'm listening to it through headphones and things. I mean, I love it, but it's not the same. It's not the same as putting a record on a turntable, putting a CD in machine and letting the music surround you as opposed to you immersing yourself in it. But I so fundamentally, yes, I still have a huge passion for it.
What you talked a bit about listening to radio, World Service and whatever, when if you come back to this country, were you aware of pirate radio at all?
Well, no, because we were abroad then. We literally just got back to the UK in 67, a week before Radio 1 opened. And I was aware that this was very exciting. And I went into my sister's bedroom at 5 to 7 on that morning to hear Theme 1. I absolutely remember that. So, you know, from that sort of time, that and being woken up for the moonwalk 2 years later, you know, absolutely, I can see the room hearing, you know, and Tony doing the breakfast show and things like that, and just being so excited by it, just absolutely energised by it, even though I kind of hadn't had the deprivation, if you like, previously, because living abroad, you didn't kind of look at it in those terms. And so I just became a kind of, you know, a Radio 1 junkie for years been, and years and years. You
having
know.
Been inundated with those stars of the 60s, be it the Hollies, the Stones, whatever, in which way did you progress after that? Because what I remember about that era was it was a time when almost everybody had the same music in common. Pop music was a universal means of communication. Since then, we've kind of moved away where even if you look at the best-selling chart for downloads or whatever, it's a mix of lots of different styles of music rather than a universally popular pop music. So which direction have you gone musically in terms of what you really get off on?
In 1972, I heard Can't Buy a Thrill by Steely Dan, which is one of those, you know, people always talk about, you know, epiphany moments. I remember hearing Do It Again and just going, what is this? Where's this come from? This is just staggering. And immediately, you know, went out and bought the album and just played it to death forever and ever. You know, it was one of those classic moments where people, you know, even my mum, much though she loved music, was saying, please, will you take that? But it did become very, very kind of varied. I mean, I listen to anything, actually. Anything, you know, it sounds a cliche, but anything that's good. And that can be some serious heavy metal to some lovely folk music and a bit of classical music as well. I mean, it is an old cliche. There's only two kinds of music, good music and bad music. And I do think that's true.
That's absolutely true. At school, I only played rugby in my very first year because I remember the match that stopped it. Somebody jumped on me. I was severely winded, went into a panic and could never bring myself to go onto the rugby field again. But I won't ever miss a Six Nations match if it's possible to get in front of the television or indeed see it in real. What do you think is the appeal of rugby union as opposed to other sports? What are its unique qualities?
It is, to me, the ultimate team game because football, Luis Suarez or Hazard or whoever it might be, can actually almost win the game on their own. It can be fairly equal, but one individual can score a hat-trick and that doesn't... Rugby, because you're so interdependent on everybody else that's around you, you know, the prop forward is essential to give the ball for the scrum half to pass to the outside half, for it to get to the wing or whatever it might be. None of those elements of the jigsaw can work in isolation. They all have to work together. And, you know, people always talk about camaraderie and friendship and all that sort of stuff. Most of the friends I've got are people that I've played rugby with over the years. It just has an extraordinary ambience around it. And the reason that clichés are clichés is because they're true. You beat hell out of people, but then in the bar afterwards, you're the best of mates, and it just has an amazing ability to bring you together in a kind of collective feeling of warmth, if you like. And I would equate sport with music like that. I mean, I often think that you can go to a major sporting event, and the only thing that kind of approximates to that is the feeling that you get at a big live concert, wherever that might be. You're sitting there and you're energised by The Killers, for example. I went to see The Killers at Wembley last year. Just so brilliant, brilliant. And that's kind of like being at a Six Nations game almost. Except, you know, nobody wins and nobody loses.
Well, it's interesting you pick out those two things and talk about having many friends in those areas. And many of the music performers and sports people that I've come across or interviewed admit to developing all sorts of pre-performance superstitions. And they really feel it can make a difference to how the show, how the evening, how the event is going to go. Has that sort of thing ever played a part in your approach to broadcasting?
Pathetically, yes. For seven years doing Sport on 2 on a Saturday afternoon on Radio 2, and then it became Sport on 5, I had and anybody who listens to this who worked on the programme in those days will go, oh, God, I remember that. I had to have a red jelly from the BBC canteen before we went on air. Please don't ask me why. I have absolutely no idea why. In one of those little tiny pots, which always had little bits of fruit on the top. Heaven alone knows why. But it was absolutely essential.
And have you got over this now?
When I stopped doing the programme, it was just like that. I don't think I ever had another jelly in the BBC canteen again, but it was almost, you know, you talk to footballers who have to put their left sock on first before the right one and all these kind of things. Cricketers are especially, I mean, they are so neurotic, it's not true. Right pad, left pad, you know, left pad, right glove, whatever it might be. For me, one of the greatest radio shows I ever listened to was Jonathan Ross's On a Saturday Morning on Radio 2. I just thought it was the first hour, especially, when Jonathan was kind of in free form. And the blend of music as well just made it unmissable, absolutely unmissable. And so I'm working on a Saturday. I mean, I used to say to film crews, I'd say, listen, you know, we had to go and film before a match, do some opening links and things like that. I'd say, what time are we filming? 10 o'clock? I'd say, no, we're either filming at 11, which means it's a bit tight, or we're all filming at 8:30, because I had to get back to the hotel room to listen to the first hour of Jonathan's programme, because it made me feel so happy and so good and so energised that I kind of almost took that to doing the programme, because it just made me feel that good. And that's what radio can do, I think. It has that ability to have a knock-on effect on the people that are listening to it. Neurotic. Crazy.
Well, whereas much of, you know, current affairs on news broadcasting, which you did before, involves preparing and working from a script, what you do, in common with many music DJs, involves opening the mic and hoping that the brain drops the right words into your mouth. That must be a very scary thing for broadcasters.
It is, and I do think it's considerably easier in a studio environment, you know, where we're having a chat now. There's no outside influences. It's when you're out and about on a golf course at the Open. I mean, I got stung by a bee live on air at the Open Championship about 4 years ago. It's very hard not to swear in that situation, but you have to somehow click into automatic pilot and say, and don't do that. But when you're out and about, you know, with just a headset, and especially with big crowds around you, jostling you or whatever else, that's sometimes the hardest thing of all. And the other thing as well, of course, is you've got to hold a microphone. So if you have got some notes, you've got to have them on one sheet of paper, because you haven't, with the other hand, you can't keep flicking bits of paper over. So in the end, your notepad has to be your brain. It's all you've got. And sometimes, you know, I had an incident last year during the Wimbledon Championships when I made a mistake, which I've subsequently apologised for. This is not to defend it at all, but it's just to say that in the course of tens of thousands of live hours of broadcasting, in many ways, the surprising thing is it doesn't happen more often to everybody, because we're all human. And sometimes, you know, your brain takes you where you didn't want it to go.
You passed comment on the attractiveness of a young lady in the Wimbledon finals. What was the reaction to that like? Was it something that you'd anticipated, or was it a surprise? I mean, how intense was it?
I mean, it's huge. I mean, the response was overwhelming in many ways. But the strange thing about it was, I mean, the mistake I made, I made the mistake in the first place, but it was one of those classic things about, I remember going to a BBC basic training course in 1982, would have been 82, at the Langham Hotel, in the days when the BBC had its offices there as well, and being told in absolutely no uncertain terms by one of the great sort of mandarins of the BBC that whenever you made a mistake on air, never explain, never apologise. People will always think, did he really say that? But kind of in those days, there was no way of finding out anyway, because it had gone. It literally had disappeared into the ether, never to be heard of again. For 30-odd years, I've kind of always had that in my head. It's just an automatic default setting that if you make a mistake or somebody else makes a mistake, don't apologise on their behalf, because that exacerbates the issue. But the world's moved on, you know, with social media and everything else, because you only need to have one person complain. And one person becomes 100, becomes 1,000, becomes 3,000. I mean, I knew I'd made a mistake. I should have apologised there and then, unequivocally. And that, but because I still had this kind of default thing about, got to keep talking, never have dead air. You know, that's the scourge and the fear of all broadcasters, isn't it? Even when you can't think of anything to say, say something. Because a split second of dead air, sounds like an eternity and feels like three eternities.
In similar vein, how much does your kind of broadcasting demand specific pre-event preparation, or does it depend more on the accumulated knowledge over a long period of time?
I think it's the accumulated knowledge over a long, long time. And also, I very rarely do anything that's not on the day, preparation-wise. What I will do is I will get somewhere very, very early and just see how I feel that day. Because if whatever it is on a Wednesday, you actually feel very differently on the day of the broadcast than you did the day before. You know, so you can be sitting in your office on a Tuesday afternoon and it's raining outside, and you're thinking about what you could say or might say or what might be an appropriate avenue to go down. Actually, on the Wednesday morning when the sun's up and it's a lovely crisp spring day or whatever it might be, you feel completely different. So actually all the preparation needed the day before was a complete waste of time. You just throw it out. So why not save that time and do something constructive with it, something else? But I'll set the alarm early on the morning of the event, whatever the event happens to be. And that's when I do my research, because I'm in it. Today's the day. You know, it's not tomorrow. It's now. So now you've really got, you've got to get your game face on. This is when you actually do resort to all those glib sporting phrases about, focusing and, getting in the zone and all those other cliches. But it's true. It is true. That's what you have to do.
I know TV work's come to dominate your professional life. Can I ask you just to maybe think about the comparison between radio broadcasting and TV broadcasting? How do you view the two?
Well, I do think they're very different. I do think that, there are crossovers, clearly, but I do think they're very different. And it's a bit like saying to somebody about cricket and baseball. You know, you have a bat and you hit something that's projectile that's coming towards you, but the similarities there are very, very, that's almost where it ends. Radio, I think, is a very singular industry. It's very dependent on you, and you can, as a presenter, go off on a random train of thought. And the only person that actually needs to be following it is you. So long as you get back to the end, so long as you can square that circle somehow or other, you start a sentence, you've got absolutely no idea. I mean, let's face it, you start 1,000 sentences and you don't even know where the middle of the sentence is, never mind the end of it. And you're just hoping and praying that by good fortune and having done it before, that you will get, there will be a comma in there somewhere and a full stop. You can't do that on television because of cameras and VT and directors and all that sort of stuff. So you have to think much more clinically and clearly on television where your thought process is going, because you can't just go off on one.
There's always a precise destination.
It's a team. Television is a massive team operation. Like going back to what I was saying about pieces of the jigsaw, it's a massive jigsaw, whether it's the VT guys, directors, producers, whatever it might be, the floor managers, everybody is an integral part of that, and it cannot operate if one element of that jigsaw falters. Whereas on radio, you can. I mean, some of the great broadcasters, you kind of almost feel, walk in, once you've opened the microphone, they could do it on their own. The great broadcaster could just sit there and just rabbit and ramble, might play a few records, might get somebody up on the phone. You know what I mean? So you can operate autonomously, in a way, on the radio. There's no way you can do that on television. So they are very, very different from that point of view.
If the time ever came when you felt live broadcasting to camera on top of the kind of travelling that you do was just too wearing, and then somebody proposed a studio-bound role, whether it was TV or radio, would that feel to you like a backward move?
No, not at all. I mean, I think I do miss the studio environment. Just sitting in here with you now, it's lovely, because it's kind of part of what you are. Been doing it for so many years now. So, no, I mean, I would love to do a lot more studio work. I mean, time is one of the big issues. And, certainly from a practical point of view, there are chunks. The sporting calendar, the great thing about the sporting calendar is you know where you're always going to be, because it's always the same. The other thing about the sporting calendar is it's always the same, so you know where you're going to be. So it's great, and it's also, that's also its weakness as well, that the variety doesn't happen other than when the big events happen. But it does mean that in May you're always there, and in June you're always there, and I do love it. I mean, I absolutely still have a kind of childish enthusiasm for it. But it does mean that because you block out certain chunks of the year, you can't kind of commit to other stuff. But yeah, please.
I know you give a lot of your personal time to encouraging, direct involvement in sport, especially by young people. How important do you think the playing of sport is in these days when it's electronic screens that seem to provide almost everything our children need?
Well, it's one of those things that there is always a danger when I have these conversations of sounding like some desperate old fart leaning on the bar going, oh, it's much better in the old days, you know. I used to run, go and run around and then, you know, put on the vinyl and, you know, the kids today have no idea. I do think it's important because I think what sport does is it teaches you self-confidence. It teaches you how to win, but every bit as importantly, it teaches you how to lose on a daily basis. It gives you an understanding of interacting with other people in a situation where, especially in team sport, where you are dependent on them and they are equally dependent on you. So I think there are endless social skills that you develop, human skills that you develop by playing sport. Individual sport, but you're still playing against someone. You've still got to talk to them afterwards. Go to an aerobics class. There's that shared experience, whatever it might be. I'm not going to be so sort of old-fashioned as to say, you know, you've got to play rugby, football, cricket. Sport is sport. There's something for everybody. But holistically, sport offers an opportunity for the growth of the human being. And I think that is lost if you're sitting in your bedroom just playing on a computer. But I do genuinely believe in 2014 that's every bit as true as it was in 1964.
We're talking about looking at screens there, but we've become so used to seeing all the great sporting events. Where does that leave the future, do you think, for audio coverage of sporting events?
Well, if you look at the audience figures, they're still going up. And I suppose the other thing as well, as our lives get busier and busier and busier, people are still rushing helter-skelter from here to there to everywhere. I suppose it's not too far off when we're going to be watching sport on our wristwatches. We're almost there now. Or some visor that we're going to wear through our glasses that's actually beaming you an FA Cup tie or whatever it might be. I still think there will be room for broadcasters who are able to paint those pictures at great events and make the listener feel that they are almost there and they would love to be there were it not for other commitments that they had. And there are still some absolutely outstanding broadcasters, sports broadcasters on the radio, you know, outside broadcast broadcasters, who make you feel that you are right in the heart of the action when actually you're stuck in traffic on the Marylebone Road. That's a great skill, it really is, and long may that continue.
The theatre of the mind. The success of Talk Sport in our medium, in radio, has now established that station within the UK's radio ecology. What do you think have been the challenges for commercial operators competing with the Beeb in this kind of area?
Well, rights, pure and simple. Because you can talk about sport and you can talk about sport till you're blue in the face, but you actually need something live, because otherwise you end up with a very monochrome output. If you play the Carpenters all day, after a while you're going to fall asleep. Wonderful though they were. So you need a bit of Def Leppard in there. You know, Light and Shade and all those other sort of cliches. If you have nothing but people ringing in and talking on the same level, after a while you think, I've heard this already, I want to go somewhere else. You need live something to provide the stimulus and also, I think, to provide the credibility so that people know that you're actually at the events. And that's what Talk Sport's done, taking things like the British Lions Tour last summer, which I think was a huge coup for them, and the Rugby World Cup in 2011, which had previously been a complete preserve of the BBC. But, of course, whether it's radio or television, it comes down to money in the end. And the escalating price of sports rights generally, which tend to be TV led, but radio is always an add-on there. That's when it comes down. As the years go by, and I do think we're going to get to a point where, I'm not quite sure when this is, with BT's involvement at the moment, I think we could get to a point at some point in the future where where everything is pay-per-view from a sporting perspective. I think the listed events may well go by the board in the next 10, 15 years or so. And then you have to, if you want to watch Chelsea against Man United, you have to pay for that. If you want to watch England against France in the Six Nations, you have to pay for that. If you want to watch the Grand National, you have to pay for that. Because that's maybe, I mean, this is, you know, pie in the sky at the moment, but who knows how far away it is. Where will radio fit into that? And I think that's a big question mark.
Well, the whole issue of how we pay for our broadcasting is going to be a massive debate over the next few years. Just finally, John, it's always seemed to me that most of us in this business have recognised mentors or heroes who've inspired us or helped us on our way. Do you have any people that you look upon and say, he, she was an inspiration, he was my mentor?
I would love to listen to a couple of his programmes to know, actually, if they were any good. But I was at an age where I listened and was just entranced by them. Jack Jackson had programmes on, used to do them on Radio 2 on a Saturday morning occasionally. They were often bank holiday specials. I just thought it was one of the most, you know, whatever was happening on television couldn't hold a candle to this unbelievably innovative, entertaining, funny. Was it funny? Was it witty? I think my memory tells me it was, but I've absolutely no idea now.
It was
very
clever.
But I used to listen to him, and then a succession of Radio 1.
You mentioned Jonathan Ross.
Well, yeah, so I was going to say a succession of Radio 1 breakfast show jocks, because they were the people that took you to school, whether it was Tony Blackburn or Noel Edmonds or whoever. And I mentioned Hillsborough earlier on, actually, but I still think to this day one of the greatest pieces of broadcasting ever, and you can get it on YouTube, is the last minute of our Hillsborough coverage that day in 1989, when I handed over 90 seconds to six and we're going off air. And the whole studio is stunned. You don't quite know what on earth to say. And I handed to Peter Jones, who was always, you know, one of the great voices that I grew up listening to at major sporting events. He was the man who painted the picture. For Peter, it was almost irrelevant what the score was. I'm going to make you feel that you're here in the commentary box with me. So you could listen to it for a quarter of an hour. You're saying, yeah, but what is the score? Doesn't matter. I'm going to tell you about how green the grass is and how blue the sky is. But I was there. And with a minute or so to go, I just handed over to Peter, said last word to Peter Jones, who's at Hillsborough. I defy you, or anybody listening to this, to hear a better, more concise, more brilliant 1 minute of radio off the top of his head. He just did it looking out on this field of desolation. A killing field, effectively, looking out on it, and everybody in the studio just reduced to tears, really. It's just brilliant. So Peter Jones was always a massive hero of mine, and he died at the microphone at the boat race, and people always said, you know, that's what Peter would have wanted. I don't think it is.
John, thank you very much for finding the time to take part in this podcast, and my thanks also to Unique Facilities for hosting this edition. Until the next time, bye-bye.